Well, hello, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I'm reading to you today again from my story in progress. There's a great big beautiful tomorrow. Now is the best time of your life. A story that has now crested 25,000 words and should be finished in 20 days or so at the rate I'm going, sort of 500 words a day. I'm thinking like 35,000 words when it's done, which is a good long novella. In fact, if it hits 40,000 words, that's technically a novel, and it may just do that, in which case I will have accidentally written a novel. Who knew? It's not supposed to be a novel, though. It's really supposed to be a novella. Thanks to everyone who turned up to hear me and Rudy Rucker read and to do that panel, that fascinating panel with Terry Bisson in San Francisco last week. It was great to see everyone there. We had a full house, as those of you who were there saw. And certainly the science fiction in San Francisco, SF and SF people were really happy because it was the first event of their season in their new location that the Variety Foundation, the Variety Charity, had given over to them in this new screening room, and so they were really happy to see a full house on that first night. It's Sunday today as I record, and I'm about to do all my normal Sunday things. Going to go to yoga class and work on. I've already worked on one of the books, and I'm working on the other one this afternoon. And I'm going to put together my students' projects as a big blog post for tomorrow as well. My students from last semester have done their final projects and put them all online, and I'm going to be blogging the ones that they wanted to see publicized and putting them online through Boing Boing for you to find. There's some amazing stuff there. I have to tell you, I had just the brightest students this year, and they really did me proud. And some of them have really gone on to do some interesting things already. One of them is the Creative Commons intern for the summer, and another one is working at Electronic Frontier Foundation as their new intake coordinator, both of which are pretty amazing placements to have gotten to, and I'm really looking forward to having them as professional colleagues now. I guess the only other news for you is an endorsement in passing for my latest operating system. I've upgraded my Ubuntu Linux machine to the latest version of Ubuntu, Feisty Fawn, and it is running like a treat. And at the same time, I switched graphical user interfaces from the GNOME to KDE. So I'm running a flavor of Ubuntu called Kubuntu. The GNOME is kind of this hairy, hackery project, mostly dominated, as I understand it, by Americans. And KDE is mostly dominated by Germans, as I understand it. And it's, I don't know, it's a little more OS X-y. In any event, I really like it. And so if you're thinking about it, you can download from ubuntu.com, ubuntu.com, you can download a free boot CD that will boot up your computer into Ubuntu, and you can also from kubuntu.com download a bootable Kubuntu CD, and you can boot your computer up into this graphical user interface and just have a little motor around and see the applications that come with it. I'm really happy with my Linux experience so far. If I have a major complaint, I haven't found a text editor that I like as much as BBEdit. Those of you who are hardcore Unix people will no doubt write to me and tell me that I just need to learn Emacs or VI key bindings and I'll be a happy man, but I really want a graphical text editor. I've been using something called Bluefish, but it has a couple of notable deficiencies. One is that you can't select a block of text and find out how many words are in it, which for someone like me who tries to write, say, 500 words a day on a story is really hard. Actually a showstopper. And it also doesn't do one of my favorite BBEdit things, which is go through and take all of the smart quotes and other non-ASCII characters out and replace them with their equivalents. And that's really handy when I'm blogging stuff because I like to use straight up and down marks and so on because they're so much more reliable when you copy and paste them. I don't like, you've no doubt seen documents that come through where all the apostrophes have been turned into long, junky strings of, you know, ampersand, some number, and then a hash sign or a semicolon or something. I'm trying to avoid that, so I like to use those plain characters, and that was something BBEdit had. And then the last thing that it's missing is a really bad bug with its spell checker, where if you click Add Word and there's nothing in the spell check field, the whole thing crashes and takes all of your work with it. And the number of times I've lost really big projects that way, lots of work that way, and I'm very careful about it and try to save as much as I can, but it doesn't always work. And I have to tell you, it's very, very, very frustrating. So I guess that's kind of a plea. If you're a Ubuntuist, and you know of some really, really good text editor, GUI text editor, that has selection word count and especially straighten out quotes and a more reliable spell checker, I'd love to hear about it. All right, that's enough geeking out. I'm going to read you from this novella now for a while, and we'll see how it comes out. I didn't recognize Lacey when I saw her. It had been 20 years, and the years had changed her. I was out in the bush looking for wild mushrooms. Mostly you get kombucha, big ones, and they make delicious tea. Supposedly they were a little hallucinogenic, but it appeared that my marvelous immortal liver didn't much care to have me enter a state of elevated reality, so all I got out of it was tea. It was good tea, though. I had the pack with me. I built them new bodies, better suited to the quiet life among the cultists. The bodies resembled furry, mechanical squirrels. They could crawl all over you without freaking you out or making you feel threatened, which is exactly what I wanted from them. They were still frisky, even though they had aged a little and become a little less experimental, a little more prone to hanging around the carousel and its immediate grounds. The canisters containing their nervous systems and brains could keep them alive for some time yet, I was sure, but they wouldn't live forever. Lucky little bastards. It was crisp autumn, and the leaves were 10 million flaming colors, crunching underfoot as we sought out the kombuchas. I was bending to inspect something that Pepe had found. Pepe still loved to have more than one POV, and I'd given him 4 squirrels to drive at once, when I looked up. I was staring into her boots, lace-up numbers, old-fashioned, with thick waffle soles. I kept looking up. She was a woman in her mid-30s. Her hair had grown out into an irregular mob of curls, her round face rosy-cheeked from the chilly weather. Fine lines radiated out from her drawn-up bow lips, and her eyes had small lines to match at their corners. "Hello," I said. She wasn't a wirehead. I could tell that just by looking at the hair. They like to wear it short so as not to interfere with the antenna. "Jimmy," she said, putting her hand to her chest. She was wearing a smart cowl that breathed gently around her, keeping her warm and dry. I cocked my head, trying to place her. She looked so familiar, but I couldn't place her, not exactly. "Jimmy," she said, and grabbed me in a hard hug. There was a woman under that cowl, boobs and hips. She was a whole head taller than me, but the smell was the same. Or maybe it was the hug. "Lacey," I said, and squeezed back, barely getting my arms around her. She practically lifted me off my feet, and she squeezed so hard that the breath went out of me. "Lacey," I croaked, "easy there." She set me down a little reluctantly and took a step back. "Jesus Christ, Jimmy, you haven't changed at all." I shrugged. "Immortal," I said. She put her hand to her chest and looked at me, her mouth open. "Yeah, of course," she said. "Immortal." "I'm trying to cure it," I said. "Not all the way, but I thought if I could age up to, 18 or so." "Jimmy," she said, "please stop talking about this for now. I'm out of weirdness quotient for the day." I had some snacks in my bag, the tortillas and tomatoes that the cult favored for staple crops, so I sat down and spread out my picnic tarp and offered her a seat, then something to eat. She sat down and we ate together. We used to do this back in Detroit, sneak picnics together out in the boonies, in an abandoned building, or, in a pinch, cupped in one of my Mecca's hands. We fell into the easy rhythm of it as though no time at all had passed since then. For me, none had, at least not physically. I told her about the Zep ride and the daisy cutters, about the slow landing and my settling in here, bound to the carousel, not wanting to abandon it. She got a little misty when she remembered the attack on Detroit. "I remember the Zeppelin taking off, and all the explosions in the sky. I was hiding under something, a truck, I think, and trying to keep the goat from going crazy. What was her name, Louisa?" "Moldavia," I said. I couldn't believe she didn't remember that. It was like yesterday to me. "Moldavia, we ate her, you know. I remember that now. Mom and Dad couldn't get their silk into India, and the farm took a turn for the worse, and..." She broke off and rolled up another tomato salad in another tortilla, sprinkled some basil and cilantro on it from the little herb bag I kept. "What happened afterwards?" I asked. "What happened to Detroit?" "Oh," she said. "Oh, well, the Wumpuses came, of course. Took about 2 weeks for them to get through it all, and when they were done, there were so many of them that they mostly just ate each other for another week, which was really gross, but when that was done, there was just good land. We farmed it for a while, mostly redwoods, big ones, 400-footers, anything for a carbon credit. They were cheap and easy." I closed my eyes and rocked back on my tailbone. I'd stood by the carousel for 20 years because, somewhere in my mind, I expected that Dad would be getting the museum back together and that wherever the carousel was, he would come. He wouldn't abandon it. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I expected that Dad was alive, immortal, coming for me, that we'd have our immortality together. It was lonely being the only one. Redwoods, I finally said. It came out in a croak. Big Butin one, she said, eating her burrito, apparently oblivious to me. Didn't last, of course. What does? They all got some kind of blight that petrified them where they stood. We think it was some kind of exotic mesoite that traded their carbon for calcium, harvesting the good stuff for who knows what. It went top down, so it took a while for us to notice. For a while, they all stayed upright, white and chalky. Then they crumbled until they were nothing but powder, which blew away. What doesn't, I said. I was still thinking of Dad. I knew I'd get over it, though. Brain plasticity. Yeah, she said. Mom and Dad hung in there with the rest of the tree huggers for a while. But I wasn't going to stay there forever. I knew that much. I went west on my 16th, got as far as the Oregon coast. Kept in touch with the parents for a while, but they moved to Bangalore when I was about 25, so that was it for them and me. I dated this guy who found me a job maintaining these weird brain scanners at a research facility, and I did that for a while too, which would have given my parents seizures if they knew. I probably stayed in that job longer than I would have, just for that reason. But the people who ran the research station got bored or went broke. They didn't ever tell us peons, and one day they didn't show up for work. We all kept coming in and cleaning the floors and keeping the machines running and signing for deliveries for a week, but then we figured they weren't coming back. So I hit the road again. The boyfriend didn't last as long as the job. And now I'm here, and so are you. She ate another burrito. She could really put them away. She told me more minutiae from the road, places she'd been and people she'd met, talking for a long, long time. So long that I started to shiver as the sun dipped low. The pack whined around me, climbing up on my lap and my shoulders and head. Lacey was oblivious to the passage of time, her cowl keeping her warm. I had one like it that I'd bought from a traveler a couple years before, but I didn't wear it much. It was too big for me, and it tripped me up a little. We got to get going, I said. I'm freezing. She stopped talking and looked around. There was something hunted in her look. She stood up and slapped at her cowl to knock the crumbs off it, and she stood and looked around again. And then she looked around again. So, she said. So, nice to see you again, Jimmy. Really nice. You can send me email or something sometime if you want to. Good luck with everything. I stopped folding up the tarp and putting away the leftovers. Why? Where are you going? She looked around for a third time, then pointed south. That direction looks promising. Do you know what's there? I followed her finger through the woods. About a half a day's walk will get you down to Jordan Lake. Nice places around there. Holiday cottages. Keep on going and you'll hit Myrtle Beach eventually. Might take you a week or so. Where are you headed anyway? It was really great to see you. She grabbed me in another one of those hugs, so fierce that I couldn't breathe for a moment. Where are you going? I said again, once she'd released me. She felt in her cowl and found a hanky, blew her face on it, and wiped away all the stuff she'd started leaking all of a sudden. I just go, she said, finally. That's all I've done for the past 2 years, Jimmy. I just go and keep going. All the places are different, but they're all the same, too. Nothing's like what I'm looking for. What are you looking for? I don't know, but I'll know it when I see it. I just hope that I find it soon. If you go off that way, you'll end up walking all night before you get to a hotel. She laughed. I don't really use hotels, she said. I stay out here with all the nature, product of my upbringing. Once a tree hugger? I hadn't had a real conversation in 10 years. It was a million to one chance running into Lacey in the woods. Also, maybe she knew a little more about Detroit. Why don't you come over to my place, I said at last. I've got plenty of room. I promise you, my place isn't the same. She crouched down and looked in my eyes. I don't think that's such a good idea, Jimmy, she said, but thank you. We didn't really argue. We hardly discussed it. But somehow she ended up taking my hand and letting me lead her back home, ducking the occasional wirehead on the way. Back in Detroit, my dad had reconstructed the carousel's elaborate concrete ramp and queue area, but I didn't have the resources to do that here. So to get up on my carousel's apron, you had to scramble up a chest-high wall that shielded the machinery beneath the stage and seats. I got myself up, the pack skittered up around me, scaling the wall as though it were horizontal, and then I helped Lacey up. Her hands were strong and her palms were dry, her fingertips calloused and raspy on my wrists. This way, I said, and led her inside. Of course, I wasn't running the show at the time. I don't usually. Not that I have power woes. The cells that had fitted it with won't run out of isotopes for a couple of centuries yet, but it saves wear and tear on the parts, and those can be a bitch to replace. The carousel is designed to seat four audiences at once, rotating continuously around the stage in 90-degree wedges. Between each stage is a little baffle that soaks up the noise from the adjoining set and provides a little space for the operators to hide out from the customers. At least that's how I used it. I suppose I could have set up my bed on one of the stages, or on the sloping auditorium aisles. I could have even removed some of the painstakingly restored seats. But all that felt wrong, after all the work that Dad put into getting it all so cherry and pristine. So I kept my bedroll in the gap between the first two scenes, and my clothes and things between the remaining gaps. The Pax canisters were stashed under the stage in the third scene, which held a little maintenance hollow that we'd always kept tools and such in. Lacey laughed when I let her in. You live here? I forget. Did you ever get to ride this? No, but I remember when you brought it back. We all came out to watch the mechas carry it through our forest. You knocked out a bunch of trees to make way. I shrugged. It's a wide load. So what's it do? I showed her, turning it on and then rushing to sit down next to her. The lights went down and the curtains parted, and a spotlight played over the old General Electric logo. I love that logo. Imagine a time when there were companies that made their fortune being generally electrical. These days, electrical stuff was very specific indeed. The narration started. Dad told me that the actor's name was Gene Shepard, and I'd heard his spiel a billion times, so often that I sometimes mixed up his calm, warm baritone with my memory of my father's voice, the two all blended in my infinitely plastic mind. The narrator welcomed us to Walt Disney's Carousel of Progress and told us some of its history, then started with the real, heavy philosophy. The challenge always lies ahead, and as long as man dreams and works and builds together, these years too can be the best time of your life. I looked at Lacey to see if she'd noticed the way that the voice over had just dropped that on us. The challenge always lies ahead. Progress! She was looking heavy-lidded but attentive. The curtains parted, and we got to that first scene. Dad, not my dad, the dad on stage, was wearing a cravat and fanning himself with a newspaper. The dog lay at his feet, doing comedy barks. Dad told us all about the miracle of his icebox, holds 50 pounds of ice, and his gas lamps. Then the lights came up on the scrim scenes and the wings of the stage, and we got to meet Mom, who was ironing. Mom complained that even though it only takes 5 hours to do the laundry with her new wash day Marvel, her spare time is taken up with canning and cleaning the oven. This was supposed to be funny. Then the other side lit up, and we got to meet Jimmy, not me, the son. His name is also Jimmy. I'm sure it's just a coincidence. After all, I'd been around for years before Dad got the carousel, and Mom probably wouldn't have let him name me after an old robot. Probably. Jimmy was looking through a stereoscope at pornography. Well, pictures of hoochie-coochie girls, and Dad gave him a good-natured ribbing. I'd seen this scene hundreds of times, but this time, sitting next to Lacey, remembering our necking sessions, it made me a little uncomfortable. The remaining scenes introduced Sister, in a corset, worrying that she is indecent, and Grandma and Grandpa listening to a talking machine with their pet parrot. Then it was over, and the singing started. There's a great big beautiful tomorrow, shining at the end of every day. And the stage rotated. We came around to the next scene, the 1920s and electricity, and I heard a sound from Lacey beside me. She was snoring. Her head was down on her chest and she was sleeping soundly. Her lips were parted a little and her face looked worried in sleep. I realized that she'd looked worried since I'd met her. I got up and stopped the ride, resetting all the shows and powering them down. From the four quadrants of the carousel, I heard robots ceasing their spiels and going to sleep. The pack, who didn't much care for the show, came out of hiding and began to race around the aisles, nipping at each other's heels. Lacey was going to have to sleep somewhere. I hadn't really thought about that. I went and checked out my narrow bed. I'd filled the space between two stages with a pile of pillows. It was comfortable enough. Did it smell bad? Maybe it did. The shower was outside in a little prefab building I bought off a traveler, and I didn't always remember to use it. Lacey probably had some kind of bed anyway. I got up and grabbed her pack. It felt like it was full of rocks. Man, she had to be strong. Another perk of adulthood, of mortality. I gave her shoulder a little shake, and her head lolled and she snored. I gave her another shake, a little harder this time. Her eyes opened a crack. Then she straightened up slowly and closed her mouth a few times, and opened and closed her mouth a few times. "It's been a long day," she said. "Sorry, Jimmy." I showed her my bed, and she laughed. "It's like the den of some burrowing animal." I felt obscurely ashamed. 20 years here, and I had practically nothing to show for it. The pack's new bodies, the maintenance I'd done on the carousel, my pathetic pile of pillows. She put her arm around my shoulder and gave me a squeeze. "It's great," she said. "It's just the kind of thing I would have loved 20 years ago." That made me feel even worse. I slumped. "Poor Jimmy," she said. "You're very generous to offer me a place to sleep, you know." "Do you have a bed in your pack?" She nodded. "I do, indeed. But screw it. It's a pain to set up. I don't need it here. Besides, I'm so tired I could drop where I stand." I told her, warning her to keep a low profile. I wasn't sure how I was going to explain her to the cultists, who'd want her to get a wire in her head if she wasn't just passing through, and I started to dig through my clothes, looking for enough stuff to make another bed out of between two of the other theater sections. She came back, shivering a little, clapping her hands together. "Cold around here at night," she said, before casually pulling her cowl over her head, then stripping off her sweater, spider goat silk it looked like, and then her tights. Just as quick as that, she was naked. I'd never seen a naked woman before. I know that sounds silly, but physiologically, I was still a little kid. I didn't have a girlfriend. Every now and then, I'd get a little curious about it, feeling something that might be horniness, like an itch somewhere in my lower belly, but most of the time, I didn't think about sex. The cultists had plenty of sex, but behind closed doors. Once I'd seen some pornography that a traveler had brought through, but she'd snatched it away as soon as she'd noticed me eyeballing it, warning me that this wasn't the kind of thing a kid like me should be looking at. I didn't bother to explain my unique chronological circumstances. My eyes were flicking from one part of her to another. Her breasts, her thighs, the curls at her pubis. I'd seen Dad naked every now and again, but not for decades. I'd seen pubic hair before, but it had never been this interesting. She had little tufts of hair in her armpits, too. So much hair! She seemed not to notice me staring, but she eventually turned away and bent to rummage in her pack. Her genitals winked at me as she did. I realized that I had an erection, a strange little boner in my pants. I got them now and again, but they were usually just a nuisance, something that got in the way. She straightened up, holding a long shirt that she slipped into. It hung down to her thighs. "All right," she said. "Me to bed. You sleep left or right?" It took me a minute to get that she was asking me a question. I blinked a couple times. "What? Left or right side of the bed? I can do either." I fumbled for words. "I'm going to sleep over there." I pointed at the pile of clothes I'd been assembling. She clucked her tongue and crossed her eyes. "Don't be stupid. There's room for both of us there. I'm not going to put you out of your bed. Get in." I hesitated. "Get in," she said, clapping her hands. I turned away and awkwardly stripped down to my underpants and shirt. I worried again that I might smell. I didn't wash my clothes all that often. They were wicking and dirt shedding and had impregnated antibacterials, so I didn't see why I should. But maybe I smelled. The cultist wouldn't say anything. Wireheads didn't notice that kind of thing. She clapped her hands again and pointed at the pillow. "March, young man!" Then I was whirling back in time. That was what Dad used to say when I was dragging my ass around. Had I told her that? Did she know it anyway? Had she guessed? Was it a coincidence? She repeated herself and pointed. I crawled into the bed. The pack bounded in after me, assuming their usual positions all around me, snuggling and burrowing among the pillows. She laughed. A moment later, the pillow shifted around me as she climbed in next to me. I tried to press myself up against the wall, giving her as much space as possible, but she gathered me in her arms and squeezed me like a teddy bear. "Good night, Jimmy," she said. She smelled of soap and her hair smelled of wood smoke. It tickled my cheeks. She kissed the top of my head. A weird thing happened then. I stopped thinking about her being naked. I stopped thinking about her being my old friend Lacey. Suddenly, all I could think about was how good this felt, being held to a soft bosom, enfolded in strong arms. Dad hugged me plenty, but I didn't remember my mother. She died not long after I was born, poisoned by Detroit. She hadn't eaten her yogurt, didn't get her microbes, and so her liver gave out. Dad barely talked about her, and the photos of her had vanished with Detroit itself, consumed by some wumpus and turned into arable land. Lacey squeezed me again, and I found that I was crying. Silently at first, Then I must have let out a whimper because she went shh, shh, and squeezed me harder. "It's okay," she murmured into my hair, and words like that, and rocked me back and forth, and then I was crying harder. I cried myself out there in the pillows in Lacey's arms. I don't know what I wept for, but I remember the feeling as not altogether sad. There was some joy there, a feeling of homecoming in the arms of my old friend. The pack snuggled in among us, and they were ticklish, and soon we were both laughing and rocking back and forth. "Good night, Lacey," I said. "Good night, Jimmy," she said. She kissed the top of my head again and squeezed me harder, and I let myself relax in her arms.